Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
You know, Dan, you've been an expert in handling other people's money for a long time, and today there's an interesting new survey out, and we have a very interesting guest to tell you all about it. He's Stuart Robertson. He's president of Capital One Advisory's 401k service, and is here to talk about it. And Dan, because I got all this background noise, I'm going to go right back to you to start the questioning.
Thank you, Don. Well, good. I guess it's still morning there, even though it's afternoon here, Stuart. thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
So let's start off with give everybody where they can reach you. Do you have a website that you can give out for your firm?
Yeah, at Capital One, we offer two 401k offerings. One really focused on helping that small business get a great low-cost, easy-run plan. That's spark401k.com, and you can go right there and get online quotes and questions answered, and they're backed by small business experts. And then we have a ShareBuilder 401k, which is really move for our mid-market offering and for those who are considering an index-based fiduciary coverage for their larger plans.
So do you do the administration of the plan, or do you also custodial assets and do transactions?
So, yeah, great question. So with Capital One Advisors and our 401k offerings, we really manage the plan consulting and determining, what plan design works and the buying and pricing of that plan. And every plan goes through that online, whether they're a small business or a big business. We do outsource our record keeping to one of two platforms based on the complexity and size of the plan. And then we have an investment committee that takes on what they call an ERISA 338. And what that really means is it takes on every plan has to run the plan in the best interest of employees. So we're not a fund provider, so we take an unbiased look at the different equity and fixed income and all sorts of funds out there and determine the best lineup, and it's index-based. We take that full responsibility on and take it off the employer and keep it all in line with ERISA and keeping it low cost and appropriate long-term investments. So that's the majority of what we do.
Okay, so you would be, would you be considered an investment advisor or asset allocator? What would you be?
A registered investment advisor, yes.
Registered investment advisor. And it's primarily done through index funds.
Yeah. We launched with ShareBuilder 401k, if not the first, the second, all ETF-based 401k offering. We do have one money market for cash, which is a mutual fund. We're all about indexing and keeping costs low for that company.
I think in my practice, I've been, as I mentioned to you, I've been doing this for like almost 44 years. I was an early adopter when some of the first original exchange traded funds came out, because it seemed to me to make sense. I remember I had an opportunity many, many years ago when I was running an operation for Merrill Lynch that in 1987 I happened to be in Thorndike, Dorn, Payne & Lewis, which manages a great many of the Vanguard mutual funds, and I happened to be in their offices in the September 87 crash listening to John Neff talk to all the senior portfolio managers, and it was a scary day. And the next morning call, he said to all the managers, I never believed I would have a second opportunity to get even richer, and I think you should buy. And it was great advice. But I think that the mutual fund industry, I find it somewhat confusing that you can have people like Fidelity or Vanguard who are in the fund business also be big distributors of ETFs, and I would think that that would eat their business, their mutual fund.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I don't know all the things they're going through, but I'm sure they're looking at where the market's going and what's best, you know, hopefully is for investors, and that might be driving their change to that. But I don't fully know.
Yeah. What do you see are the changes that are taking place and will take place in the 401k market?
Yeah, so there's, you know, we've always kind of been happy to kind of wear the white hat. And when we launched into this business back in late 2005, we really looked at, you know, what's the opportunity, what's likely to change. And there's 28 million small businesses in America, and there's 535,000 401k plans. And we're all about trying to help everyone save smart for retirement and have a nice, healthy retirement nest egg. So really the 401k, what made sense, and we thought we could bring, you know, indexing with the ETFs, easy way to buy online. You know, we were first allowed quoting and purchase of plans online back in 2005, and we thought that can enable more small businesses to get access and start a plan that's affordable and low cost and easy to run. So that's, and we still see that today. It's, the penetration has been slow, and part of the survey that we'll talk about is just why small businesses do and don't have 401k plans and what's holding them back. And you know, we're really on a mission to help those folks get a great plan and save for tomorrow. So we see that coming. We also go ahead.
There are 28 million small businesses, but only 500,000 plans. It would seem like there's a lot of opportunity for growth of 401k plans.
Yes, we definitely believe that. And if it makes sense, I can dive into the survey, and that's actually what it really reinforces. Some of the stuff we hear from our small business advisor experts here is, you know, everyone says it's cost and complexity, and that's definitely a blocker for small businesses. But really, some of the top myths have nothing to do with that. And the number one myth is that my business isn't big enough to have a 401k plan, and you can be any size business to have a 401k plan. You can be a self-employed person and start a, you know, solo 401k plan or individual 401k plan, right? So it doesn't matter your size, you can have a plan. So that's a number one blocker out there, and that's just a perception in the marketplace, and it's a hard one to address. Just because there's no advertising, you know, you have that in your mentality, and you may not think to consider one. The number two one actually is I can't afford a match, and that's interesting because you actually don't have to have a match in a 401k plan. You can get one started, and it definitely, a match makes things more attractive, obviously, to your employees to participate, but it's not a requirement, and it's a great vehicle to get people up and saving, and you can choose to profit share on good years or bad years if that's a better way for you to help, or not at all. So there's a lot of different ways to get a plan up and running and ease into it as your business grows.
So the first two concerns that you mentioned, one was the cost. Is that probably more realistic what it was when they first came out and not realistic of today's program offerings?
Yeah, I think so. I think you've got a group of providers like Spark 401k that have come in the market and have really made it easy and affordable to get started. So let's take a 8-person company. They'll probably have a one-time setup charge. You know, we charge under $500 for that. And then they would have a monthly administration cost of $80 a month. And those are the two core costs that the employer would take on.
Is that $80 per employee or just for the plan?
No, for that business of 10 people, it would be 80, would include all 10 of those that are participating.
Okay.
And if it, from 10 to 25, our pricing goes up to the next step of, I think, 100 to 125. But it keeps it low, and it keeps it in brackets. And then if you're a business with employees starting your first plan, you can qualify for up to $500 in tax credits from the government. So, you know, your ongoing costs those first few years are likely under $1,000 for that 10-person company.
Wow.
Which is pretty inexpensive, right? And then if you do decide to match, it's likely tax-deductible for your firm. But what
sure.
I like to also really educate and make sure business owners are aware of is that, great, people like us can keep that cost low, but the other cost that is, you know, kind of why you've seen, you know, a lot of work in indexing and how do you keep costs low is really the investment expenses that the participants pay, because a lot of plans will pass higher fees and you have a lot of actively managed funds, and how those pass fees back to different folks supporting the plan can be high. And our whole thing is keep that under 1% all in. So the fund expenses, you got to include those. What's your average fund expense? Is there an investment management charge? Is there a record keeping custodial? What are all those fees that are getting passed through the participant as percent? And just keep those under 1%, right? Because every dollar you spend in investment expenses is one less dollar to market. And if someone's paying 2% and 1% over a 40-year career, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars of difference for that employee come retirement and how much they have, and the lower expense guy wins, right? So that's something to really understand.
Dan, can I jump in here with a question
that
actually came across my computer, which is, you know, you two are sold on 401ks, et cetera, but a listener asked a question, why should I have a 401k?
Well, so basically my point of view on that is if you're a business owner, small businesses that have a plan, 91% of them see the value in what it does for retention, recruitment, and saving for retirement. So they're fully realizing that value. The other thing is that most people are good at thinking about today's needs and worrying about that, but they're not focused on that 30 years from now. And a 401k is that easy, automated way with payroll that gets you saving a certain percentage for tomorrow, because most experts say you need 10 to 15% saving annually towards retirement to be able to retire. So if you have that desire or want that safety of having some money in retirement, 401k is a great automated way. It has, you know, higher contribution limits than you could do in a traditional IRA. So it has Roth 401k features. So no matter how much you earn, you can still do after tax if you're worrying about hedging taxes come retirement, if you're fortunate enough to be thinking about that, be in that situation. So it has a lot of ways to make saving easy, and it gets you on path so you do have savings come retirement.
Well, can I jump in one more question, Dan, before we go to break? And when we come out of the break, Stuart's all yours again. But if it's so good, why are, relatively speaking, so few companies, owners, utilizing it?
Yeah, it goes back to some of the things that I was talking about, is that they're not aware they can have one. They think they can't afford to match. They think it can be cost and complex to run. So all those things get in the way of getting folks in starting a plan. And it's really a lot of education and myths out there that has kind of fogged up the ability for more small business to get up and running. You know, and maybe, you know, 15 years ago, 10 years ago even, there weren't a lot of providers focusing on the small business. You know, the way 401ks were sold and still are sold in many areas is you have a registered rep and they have a small business owner as a client, and they were really kind of doing it as a favor for a small business owner who wanted one, because for them, they're not going to make money on a plan with no assets. So they didn't have a lot of desire to go out and kind of grow that marketplace. But now there's providers like us that have figure out ways to simplify it and make sure you can buy it online, take off that investment duty off of the small business owner who may or may not be a financial expert or want to deal with that. And so now there's ways with indexing and you know, those sort of things, and taking on investment management areas that can really simplify it for the small business owner, make it low cost and easy to run.
We've got to take a break right now for a commercial, but we'll be right back.
Life. It's made up of the simple day-to-day moments that keep us all running on full. Full of joy, passion, and restlessness. It's singing full on to your car radio with the windows wide open. It's a whole bunch of early morning rush hours and a few late night runs for Rocky Road. It's full of pit stops and drive-thrus. It's life, and we live it between fill-ups at Valero. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at ValeroCleanGas.com.
We're back here with Stuart Robinson. He's president of Capital One Advisors 401k Services. Dan, I'm sure you got more questions, so fire away.
Stuart, before the show started, we were talking about an area that I feel comfortable saying that there's millions upon millions of people who don't know that they have this option. When we reach 70 and a half, and if we have a qualified retirement plan, we have to start taking that money out based on the life expectancy or required distribution, minimum distribution. And if we're in the right or wrong plan, depending upon your perspective, we give up an opportunity. What we're finding is that more and more people, myself included, for example, still working very actively, as is Don, and I'm 72. I only by dumb luck did I set up a SEP IRA, which my accountant tells me that, and I have an IRA, I can continue to take money out of both programs, but I can't make any more deposits to the regular IRA, but I can make money, additional deposits in my SEP IRA. And I think it's also, you correct me if I'm wrong, also true of 401ks?
Yeah. So for those who know, SEP IRA is another type of retirement plan option for businesses they can offer. And so if it's a retirement plan for a business in general, as long as you're working there, you can keep contributing right away to that retirement program. So if you're, like you said, you're over 70 and RMDs are required, your traditional IRA, you're going to have to make some RMDs from that, and that obviously increases each year as you age. But if you're actively working and contributing to that 401k or SEP IRA, that's not going to stop. And I guess the other point to make is that in a SEP IRA, employees don't make any contributions. It all comes from the employer. But because you're the employer, you're contributing to it, yeah, obviously all the employees benefit from who are part of that plan and can receive those.
So it,
yep.
There's another provision that I wanted to discuss with you. Again, not well known. If you're working and you're not taking your required distribution because you're not 70 and a half, and you have a small business, sole proprietorship, you can have a SEP IRA, and your contribution in that SEP IRA for a small business person can be up to 25% of the earned income in to you in the business, up to about $49,000. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, as I say, it's actually a little bit more than that. So in a solo 401k plan, so a sole proprietor can have that, or a SEP IRA, you can actually put up to $54,000 a year in that. And if you're over 50, in a 401k plan, you can actually put up to $60,000 in that because of the catch-up contribution. So basically, as a solo 401k or sole proprietor person, you're both the owner and the employee. And you kind of talked about the how you calculate it. It can be 20% of your net Schedule C, or it can be 25% of W-2 income. But that is how much you can put in. And with a 401k plan, you get there a little faster because you, as an employee, you could put in your $18,000 or $24,000 if you're over 50 as an employee, and then you can do the other, profit share back to yourself or match or employer contribution back to yourself with the remaining, assuming you have the income, right? So that's it actually is pretty exciting. You can drop your tax bracket if you're fortunate to be in that situation.
No, I have a lot of friends. I live on in the Gulf of Mexico on an island, and it's the senior area, and I've been talking to my golf buddies about it, and they think I'm crazy. but they call their accountants, and they're right. And these guys are over 70. They're still actively in still managing, help manage the businesses. Maybe they brought their children in to run it, but they, chairman of the board, and still active in it and draw a salary. They just thought it was too good to be true. But now you're telling me it's 54,000, not 49, but and maybe up to 60. So that's a
yep.
That's a great tip, Don, for our listeners, how to get a lot more money into your retirement plan, and especially why I think this is so important is that I believe that, and I'm not an actuary, but I believe that the actuaries at the government, their mortality tables and their required distributions have not really caught up with the increased longevity of the American public. And I have this great fear that people are going to run out of money before they die. And this particular provision, especially if you're continuing to work, is a way to replace some of those dollars that you distributed out of your plan when you had to do it on an RMD and replenish or rebuild your retirement plan. I think it's a terrific idea.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And the other thing to know in that 401k plan, if you're, say, you're not a supplier, but you're actually an employee in a firm with a plan and have 25 employees, you actually have the same limits. It's just, obviously it depends on how much you earn and how much employer contribution you're receiving, because you as an employee can do the 18 to the 24, depending on your age. And then really, what are you getting from your employer on a match? You can actually go up to the 54 cap if you were in that earning situation. So great for sole proprietors and great for employees who continue to work to save a lot
right.
of time.
I agree. The other thing I wanted to talk in the last few minutes we have is this new fiduciary rule from the Department of Labor, which seems to be tagged to IRAs, 401ks, and SEP IRAs, any qualified retirement plan, that is really causing some serious problems. And I want to give you, as a practitioner, I want to give you a specific example in my practice what has happened. I don't know if you know about what some of the firms are doing, but Merrill Lynch is, in order to avoid being non-compliant with the fiduciary rule, is no longer charging commissions on transactions in qualified retirement accounts. They are assessing an annual fee based on the average of activity over the previous 2 years. And all of my retirement accounts and regular accounts are discretionary accounts because I'm a registered investment advisor. And I'm not aligned with Merrill or anybody else. But when I looked at what they wanted to charge in lieu of commission, an asset-based fee, I'm moving, and I'm not embarrassed to tell you, I'm moving accounts to Charles Schwab, and I'm looking at Fidelity, because there's a transaction fee $4.95 versus paying $500-$700 a month based on assets that I may not be an active trader. So I've got clients that are shifting. So are you said you were a 1%, less than 1% fee. Has the fiduciary rule impacted your business?
Well, in our line of business on a 401k, not really. So a lot of the ZL rules were making sure that for retirement plans, that whether you're, as a registered investment advisor, you're always supposed to act in the best interest of your client. But a registered rep, has
right.
to be suitability, right? So is it suitable? Could it be suitable for this investor? So it's really working
right.
to correct that for retirement plans, that they're going to act in the best interest, which is, has them rethink about what funds they might do, how they might charge for it, and so you're hearing how Merrill may do that. How we do things here is we've always, it's actually called an ERISA 338 advisor, and I started talking about this a while ago, but this has always ensured that we act in the best interest of our employees and their participants, right, in what those investment offerings are. Because we take on this high standard of ensuring that the investments are appropriate for retirement, we care about cost matters, and we care about diversification. So because we've always had that status and taken on, which is pretty much the highest status you can take on a 401k plan, and it actually removes that fiduciary burden from the employer. They actually, you know, if there's ever a lawsuit about the investments that are offered, it would be on us, show the due diligence we do, and that we follow our investment policy and do all the analysis we say we're doing, which we showcase in all the different reports we send to our plan sponsors. But so from that standpoint, we're in a really good shape, and there was really no change for us in how we offer and do the due diligence and hard work around what a great fund lineup can be for a 401k plan. But most providers, you know, they're in the industry, you know, your general 401k plan, most of the people servicing or the provider servicing aren't taking on that fiduciary duty. It falls on the employer, but now at least they should be getting better options and better consultation from the providers on what's best for their plan. So, like I said, wasn't a big concern for us, but it's definitely a big deal in the industry because most aren't set up in the same fashion as us. The other thing that we do is we automatically lower pricing as the plan grows. So if assets go past certain milestones, like $500,000, $2 million, we lower the asset management charge we do for those services. And so it might, you know, our all-in costs are under 1%, but, you know, for that $50 million plan, it may well be under, you know, 30. So it's, or 0.3, you know, 30 bips. So it's, you know, we really think about how do we always keep it low cost and in the best interest of those employees and firms using us.
I hate to break in because this is a fascinating conversation, but Stuart, we've run out of time. Can you tell our audience again your website and how people can reach you?
Absolutely. Just go to spark401k.com, S-P-A-R-K, 401k.com, and that'll get you right to our site. And we have phone numbers and advisors that'll talk to you. You can get a quote for pricing online, buy a plan online, learn all about the different plan design, or just give one of our advisors a call, and they'll talk you through the whole thing and educate you on what might be right for your business. Make sure it's actually right for your business. There are times where a 401k plan is not the right option, so they'll talk you through what's right and what plan design if it makes sense to get started.
Thanks so much for being with us, Stuart. You and Dan have to have another conversation on air. I found
love it
fascinating.
Thank you, Stuart.
Great. All right, y'all take care. Bye now.
Dan, a word from our sponsor before our next guest.
Sure.
Before you hear this, or this, or even this, before you turn a key, step on the gas and let it rip, before you get up and out and on the road, you have to be fueled by something. Make sure that something is Valero. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at valerocleangas.com.
You know, Dan, over the weekend, there was a fascinating article in the New York Times about why the pollsters got everything wrong about the November election. And one of the things they said is because the polls can't really get to learn what respondents are really thinking. Our next guest, Kate Newland, her specialty is helping companies learn especially what consumers really think about products and services. Kate, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don. I appreciate it.
Well, Kate, tell us a little bit about yourself, your company, and your website before we do anything else.
Well, basically what we do here at Kate Newland Consulting is we mine the emotional meaning of brands and businesses in order for our clients to be able to leverage that for margin. It's the simplest way to put that, that our belief is that there's a great deal of equity and value that is trapped within consumer brands, consumer-facing businesses. And what we do is find that emotional meaning for our clients. So we work with consumers typically under hypnosis, where we can find what their memories and what their longings are, and then we can build platforms to help them release that equity, release that margin for better for all, right? For the, better for the consumers and better for the businesses.
And your website?
KateNewlin.com, cleverly enough. N-E-W-L-I-N.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start off and then turn it over to Stan, Dan. But my question is, in this consumer change that seems to be affecting all retailers across the world, what have you discovered, what have you learned that a small business leaders can also learn and benefit from?
You know, one of the great insights. I wrote a book called Shopportunity, and I interviewed a whole lot of people around the country and around, that work on brands in the U.S., but also in the developed world. And one fellow from Procter & Gamble gave me kind of the linchpin of the whole thesis, which is that one generation of marketers has addicted three generations of consumers to the heroin of price promotion. And I think if you really think about that, so much of what the messaging is from brands is buy one, get one, or right now 20% off. You know, there's a tremendous amount of screaming at the consumer about price being the only variable that matters. And what we've seen over the years is, and I'm speaking now of working within a consumer economy, so like the United States, like any developed nation where there market where there are brands, those brands are encoded with a great deal of meaning. They're a way that we badge ourselves with who we are. They're a way of telling ourselves and others which kind of smartphone do we use, what kind of car do we drive. All of those mechanisms are ways that we telegraph meaning and identity. And when we only, when the marketers only telegraph cheaper, it denudes the whole category. It denudes the whole process of consumption. And it carves costs out of the system, which what you're referencing is this amazing sound that you hear is the movement out of conventional sales channels and to online. Just a tremendous, because there's no value. If you take all the costs out of all the money out of the system that can be used to pay salespeople and can be used for good ecosystems, for good ambiance within a retail environment, and you treat people as if they are, I want to call them incipient thieves when they come in and you're monitoring how many items they take into the dressing room and you're watching them like they cannot be trusted, then it's a, you know, we move people to a place of anxiety when they're shopping rather than a place of discovery. We've done a great deal of work in the world of shoppers in the retail setting, and what they want to feel is one very powerful emotion, which is they want to feel lucky. They want to feel like they found the right shoes to go with the dress or the shirt that goes with the, you know, like they want to feel lucky. And it's across all channels. They want to find that right thing. But all we're screaming at them is cheaper. That becomes the default setting, is how cheaply can I get this, which erodes the price, erodes the feeling of joy that could and should accommodate accompany shopping. So,
Dan, I'm going to interrupt you.
Yeah.
Dan, I'm sure you have a couple of questions.
Oh, yeah. There's a couple of different directions I want to go, so let me start off. I agree with you with price, and I want to use something that I follow. After the Great Recession of 2008, the pricing advertising of automobiles changed dramatically. And today what we have was where prior to 2008, they would run a sale and you could get $1,000 off. now you see car manufacturers that are running advertisements that are talking about a 20% discount off the retail price, so that they've abandoned quality, reputation, style, and you're right, they're marketing on price. Very prevalent to me in the automobile industry. And at the time when they started doing this, I said they're never going to get back to a higher margin on their automobiles because they have trained the consumer to forget about what the sticker is on the window and how much of a discount can the consumer finagle from the dealer. So I totally agree with what you're talking about.
It's tragic, really, because when we did the research around the most powerful shopping experience for men, it was for their first car. And, you know, they go with their dads typically. They feel this sense of significance. They feel lucky. They're going to find the right car. It's a tremendously powerful shopping experience, which has been denuded of its meaning, at just exactly how you describe. And what you do is you level the playing field and say, well, there is no value in the nameplate on the car. What you got is a generation of consumers, at least a generation that has become price loyal, and they just are going to find that price, and in whichever marquee name plate is on it, there's a lack of belief that anything is worth paying more for. And yet, you know, there are brands that do command because of their heritage, because of the romance of them, that they can command that. But it's the top of the pyramid. It's not what most people are going to be buying.
Right. Give you a personal experience. I used to hate to go buy cars because they take so long to get it done.
Yeah.
And so what I switched from buying cars to leasing cars. Mm-hmm. And I would go in, and I've done this. I don't do this anymore because I'm going to tell you what I replaced it with. I used to go into a dealer, and the saleswoman would greet me at the door, and I said, look, the clock just started. We've got 60 minutes to complete this deal. And if we can't complete it in 60 minutes, I'm telling you right now, I'm walking out the door at 60 minutes. And I had no qualms about walking out the door. I would do it.
Sure.
Now I use a broker. And on the most recent car that I bought, my wife and I flew up to Washington National Airport. He met us in the parking garage. I signed three pieces of paper. He gave me the keys, and we were done.
And how much of the work of that was conducted online? In other words, how did you determine the car you wanted?
I did some shopping online, looking for an SUV and a midsize, and I was looking at a Consumer Report rating, but I didn't spend hours doing that. I knew where I wanted to go. And then when I called the broker, I said, here are three cars that I'm interested in buying. See what you can do for a deal. And he came back to me and he says, I got this one, this one, and this one. I think this is the best deal. And then that was it. He made all the arrangements and I picked up the car. The other thing I want to ask you about, because I thought about it when you first started talking, and I don't know whether this is true. This could be urban legend. But there used to be a thing, there used to be a time when the American consumer believed that advertisers used subliminal messages on television. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious of whether or not you've tested that, whether that was true when you were doing hypnosis.
You know, no, that because we're not looking for that. You know, what we're looking for is, and we ask the same six questions, and we've been doing this now for 15 years, so we've got quite a baseline of interviews done. But we ask them their first, their most powerful, and their most recent experience in a category, and their first, most powerful, most recent experience with the brand. And what you get with the first and most powerful experiences are typically the promises that a brand or a category makes, the hopes, and then for the most recent, you get the disappointments. Typically, the way in which you go into a shopping or a buying experience with hope and anticipation, and it is just sucked dry. Almost in a conspiracy of foolishness in the ways that consumers are treated. I gave a speech a couple of weeks ago to small retailers, small independent retailers. It was down in Atlanta. And this should be the heat of the market, right, where you can give personalized service, where you can tell the backstory of how you got this, you know, piece of silver or this piece of jewelry or this tabletop or whatever the item is that you're selling. In a small retail environment, when the customer comes in, you should be able to really, you know, wax lyric about the joy of this particular item that they're interested in. And instead, and that was the thesis of the speech, is that, you know, the big, big jumbo ones are going to have to go online, but people are going to want this curated, emotional, personal discovery experience. And but what I heard in the Q&A was people complaining bitterly about the customers, that they come in and they might have a child with them, or they might be on their cell phones and not paying attention. You know, like there's a litany of complaints about consumers, and I'm sure, you know, that, you know, it's all fair, but that us versus them kind of mentality is what further erodes the shopping experience from meaning. It is part of the problem. It's just the reason that you'd give them the edict of, I'm going to do this for 60 minutes, and if you can't sell me the car in 60 minutes, I'm out of here. There's right. An adversarial quality to it. But it's on both sides of the door. You know, it's a hostile environment, and so of course it's easier to go on Amazon and go through all of it.
I'm going to interrupt you right now for one moment. We're talking with Kate Newland to hear from our sponsors, and then we'll be right back.
Before you hear this or this. Or even this. Before you turn a key, step on the gas and let it rip. Before you get up and out and on the road, you have to be fueled by something. Make sure that something is Valero. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at ValeroCleanGas.com.
We're back here with Kate Newland, who tells us what consumers really think in a variety of different ways. Kate, Dan, I'm going to ask one question. Over the weekend, I went to the accessory show, actually several shows, at the Jacob Javits. And in looking at the various items, clothing, et cetera, foundations, et cetera, I was hit by the fact that value seems not to be the key issue, but rather price or exclusivity. Am I right or wrong?
You're definitely right. But we're teaching them. It's like a dog whistle. We're teaching consumers that price is the only variable that matters. And, you know, if you want to see this in very sharp relief, go to Europe. When you look at France, you can walk through their shopping arenas, and except for two periods, January and August, there are no sales. So they're freed up to actually experience the shopping experience with great sales staff, educated professional sales staff that is compensated, and a beautiful environment. And twice a year, there are sales that do what sales are meant to do, which is to clean out inventory and let them reset for the season ahead. It's a tragedy to see. There's no time to explain, you know, the different markers of quality. There's nobody in those stores that really want to explain that, and the consumer sees them as adversaries It's just a tragic experience at the writ large in the Macy's of the world and the Walmarts and those kinds of places. The tiny boutiques, the very, very high quality luxury, I think in this country has started down that slippery slope. They do have promotional items. They do have things where you can find them at a certain price point. So it's hard. Just the way Stan was saying that, Dan was saying that there's an issue about can the auto manufacturers ever change the pricing theory that they've gone to now. It's very hard to unring those bells once a whole industry just keeps clamoring at consumers that price, get it over here, no, over here, 20% off if you buy today. All of that is just hard to counteract. I think small, beautifully run companies, firms, retailers that do, perfect cheeses, perfect wines. I mean, think about the great experiences that you're willing to leave home for. And they typically are where the person behind the counter can educate you, can teach you something, and is willing to, cares about what they're doing. Who doesn't promote on price? Well, gee whiz, the smartphone people, Apple, like you're not shopping. The telephony provider may give you different deals, but the cell phone itself is magical enough that it continues to be worth what they say it's worth. Movies don't discount because it's an experience. You go in there and you're getting something emotional in the dark with a lot of strangers, and yet you feel like you've done something social. Starbucks doesn't discount. Again, you go in, you're getting something. You're spending $5 for a cup of coffee, and you're sitting in a place that looks like every other Starbucks with people that you don't know typically. But it's a shared experience at a fair price point, and there's no discounting. And I think you have to look at who doesn't do it in order to figure out how to get out of that cycle, because it's very hard to break once you enter it.
Dan, back to you.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a question. Do you provide consulting services?
Yes.
Or are you simply research?
No. We consult with clients who are typically they're at a crossroads, right? They've tried the usual things and it's not working. They know that if they don't fix it, it's a big problem, and if they do fix it, it's a big, big answer. That gets them out of that price spiral. So, indeed, that is the bulk of what we do.
I don't ask you to ask by names, but what kind of companies, I listened to what you're saying, and I write for 7 different blogs, and I did a piece on retail, and I talked about big box stores going into them. They may have a great price point, but if you need somebody to help you, you can't find anybody in the store that has any clue. But setting that aside, what kind of companies have been successful in changing in price points? And then I have a value proposition that I experienced yesterday that's unbelievable. So let's deal with the first question.
All right. So
what kind of companies have you helped?
Nabisco is the one that allows me to use the case study all the time. I mean, they let me write about it in one of the books. I can speak about it, so I'll share that one with you quickly. Nabisco was facing an issue which their channel partners were complaining to them about. So Walmart and Kroger's were coming to the president of Nabisco and saying, we have videotapes of women starting down the cookie aisle and backing out, and you have to solve this because you're what they call in the grocery business, you're the category captain. So they first tried, Nabisco first tried an advertising strategy, a promotional strategy, which was buy one, get one. And that did not work. That did not lure her back down the aisle. And then they tried another consulting firm, and who told them they had too many different sizes and SKUs of products, and they needed to get rid of some, which they weren't willing to do. So then they got to me, and we went in, we hypnotized consumers, and we found out what the archetypal meaning of packaged cookies, sweet baked goods, are, which is that my mother loves me, right? It's I'm sitting in my high chair, and she's making something, and it's I can't taste it. I can't touch the stove. I smell it. It's, you know, but she's doing something for me. Or she leaves three Oreos and a glass of milk for me after school, and I know my mother loves me. Now, with men, they say, and so I told her I loved her back. With women, which were the problem for the brand, they'd say, if she loved me so much, why did she addict me to something that puts fat on my thighs? So there was this edge to it. And what was happening is they knew, the most powerful, the most recent part, the disappointment, was they knew that if they brought that box of Oreos home and they put it in the cupboard, at 3 o'clock in the morning, that box would wake them up, and they would need to start eating Oreos. And they didn't trust themselves. So they went and... You know, they learned you have to bring yourself home from the grocery store, but you don't have to bring the Oreos home. And this was the business problem facing Nabisco and its channel partners, was a sharp reduction in sales. So we went in and we understood what it was. She needed the anticipation. She needed control. So then the second phase of our work is we bring in a bunch of wicked smart people from a lot of different categories and who have what we call analogous and functional expertise. So they've worked in this area, or they've seen a product category go south on a company, they've had channel partner issues, whatever it was. We bring them in and we tell them what we've learned from the consumer, that she didn't trust herself with the product. And we had food psychologists, we had all sorts of folks there, and we came up with, you know, we needed to give her control back. And what's the way to do that was to figure out a dose that she would know if she opened this package she could eat it all, which is how we developed the 100 calorie packs for Nabisco. Now, 100 calorie packs were a dose, right, of small cookies that tasted like Oreos, tasted like Chips Ahoy, but they were you could eat the whole package and you were at 100 calories. That control, then six of those packages to a box that was then also wrapped again, gave her a reason to go down that aisle. And then when she was down the aisle, she would buy the conventional ones for her family. And so the kids were still getting the three Oreos and a glass of milk when they came home from school. And now they had a whole new sub-brand within Oreos, Chips Ahoy, and the rest of them. That was our work. It was worth $1 billion in sales within the first year. It ignited the category and got them to, you know, like there's Orville Redenbacher 100-calorie pack. The insight was not brand-specific. It was that portion control was what this woman needed. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of work.
Kate, I hate to break in like this, but we're rapidly running to the end of our time together. It's been really fascinating. Dan, one more quick question and one more quick answer. I didn't think we got to your second question.
We didn't. I was back in New Jersey yesterday visiting with my newest grandchild, and his mom and dad took number four. His mom and dad took me to a place called Duck, D-U-C-K, Donuts. And this is a place where you have a plain yellow donut, and then you can pick all of the toppings or any combination of toppings.
Mm-hmm.
And we bought a dozen donuts at Dunkin' Donuts would cost about $6, $7. We bought a dozen donuts and didn't flinch at paying $23 for the dozen donuts.
For the experience, the customization.
Right.
Right.
And my wife, when she saw the video, she She said, so how many did you have? I had three. She said, you're telling me that my son and daughter-in-law ate 9 donuts yesterday? Every one of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they tried
they
to
made it into an experience rather than just habitual. You know,
I hate to break up this donut break, but we have to. Kate, tell us once again your website.
It's katenewlin.com, KateNewlin.com.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Dan, any final thoughts for Kate?
Well, I enjoyed it. I mean, it's a lot of things that I've written about and we've talked about on the show. Value will ultimately win out if you can figure out what the right value is for the customer. So it was
absolutely
a pleasure having you on the show, and we'll love to have you back again sometime. Take care, dear.
Terrific. Thank you.
And now we have a word, our tip of the day from Dan Perkins.
Dan Perkins here from Songs and Stories for Soldiers with your veterans tip of the day. As a veteran, are you getting everything that you're entitled to? Many merchants are proud to offer discounts to veterans. They can be anything from a big box store to the corner market. Most don't do a very good job of promoting their veterans programs, so you'll have to do a little homework and find them on your own. This is especially important if you're making a major purchase like appliances or even a new car. So when you're going to the store, get into the habit of asking the salesperson, do you offer discounts to veterans? If they say yes, then ask how much. If you need a new refrigerator or a new washer and dryer, the discount for you could be significant. So make sure you get what you're entitled to by stepping up and asking, do you offer discounts for veterans? Your wallet will be better off for asking. This has been Dan Perkins with your Songs and Stories for Soldiers.us Veterans Tip of the Day.
Life, it's made up of the simple day-to-day moments that keep us all running on full of joy, passion, and restlessness. It's singing full on to your car radio with the windows wide open. It's a whole bunch of early morning rush hours and a few late night runs for Rocky Road. It's full of pit stops and drive-thrus. It's life, and we live it between fill-ups at Valero. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at ValeroCleanGas.com.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Well, Dan, we're coming towards the end of another hour. We've had two interesting guests. I, for one, enjoyed listening to two advisors who are as knowledgeable as you two in the beginning. And Kate Newlin really did a lot for me. What were your thoughts?
Oh, I enjoyed the show, and I thought that was an interesting dialogue. And our listeners learned something. And by the way, you know, if you're listening to the program for the first time, make sure you invite your entrepreneurial friends to join us on either Tuesday morning or Thursday evening. And if you missed a part of the show or you want to go back and listen to another segment of another show, you can get us at recalculating.biz, and you can load down any show you want. So we'll talk to you next week. This is Dan Perkins.
And this is Don Mazzella wishing you and all yours a really great rest of the summer.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.
All right, sir. Thank you.
How you doing? Dan,
I'm doing good. How are you?
Dan, can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, this is Dan Perkins. I'm the co-host. And your name, sir?
My name is Bob.
How do we, I'm sorry.
This is Battery Room.
I know, but I couldn't hear him say his last name.
My last name is Rue Parvar.
Rue Parvar?
Yes. Just like three syllables. Rue Parvar. Yes, Rue Parvar.
Right, good. I got it. Good. All right. So,
Rue Parvar?
Yeah, Rue Parvar.
Rue Parvar.
Rue Parvar. Right.
Rue Parvar.
Okay.
You're president of Bataroo. Correct?
Yes, sir.
Are we ready to go?
Yes.
Are we ready to go?
Okay, we're going to start in 5 seconds.
All right, sir.
And we're going to have a break in 15 for just one quick break, and then we'll be back. Rue Parvar.
This is Rue Parvar. Three syllables.
Rue Parvar.
Yes.
Okay.
Beautiful.
Well, Dan, our next guest has invented something that I think belongs in every American house. I know it's in our household because I saw them at a press preview, took one of their products home. It's called Battery Roo. I'll let him tell you all about it. But join me in welcoming Bob Rue Parvar. He's president and CEO of Battery Roo. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's a great pleasure being with you. I love you and your program, and it's an honor for me to be part of your program.
Well, first, tell us what your product does before anything else.
Well, our company named Bataroo and product name is Bataroo, actually. It's like a battery. And we got some linguistic folks to help us to come up with a name. They said Bataroo, like Yahoo. It kind of rolls nicely, battery and Bataroo. So since we are in a battery complement business, we thought we should call ourselves Bataroo. Most people do not know that billions of batteries thrown away every year, with only 20% of its original energy has been used, and the other 80% gets thrown away. So what we do in Bataroo, we try to revive those batteries and we tap into those energy and extend the life of the battery by 600% in some cases by basically having the ability to go and harness that energy and being able to extend the life of the battery. So that's basically what we do. It's a battery. It's a micro-thin, reusable stainless sleeve that wraps around your battery, your AA battery, your C battery, your D battery. They come in different form factor and has electronic circuitry that taps into the remaining energy that otherwise would have been thrown away. There are 15 billion batteries consumed every year and end up in a landfill. Imagine that, you know, billions of these batteries, they still have significant amount of energy left in them. This is very, very expensive energy, and people do not realize that. For example, the analogy would be very simple. If you buy a brand new toothpaste, and if you squeeze it from the top 5-6 times, the seventh time you squeeze, nothing comes out. But since you understand there's plenty of paste in the tube, you start squeezing from the bottom. You don't throw it away in the trash. However, the batteries, when, you know, your device says, you know, you're running low on the battery, you need to replace it, you do not realize that, you know, you still got 70-80% significant amount of energy left in the battery. You throw it away because you don't have any way to squeeze the thing out, and you don't see the energy in it. And they end up in a landfill. And so it's a very, very expensive source of energy. Imagine if your utility bill was $200 a month, and if you had to power up your house with alkaline battery, your $200 a month would have been converted to $1 million a month. So it's a very, very expensive source of power. However, it gets thrown away with significant amount of energy left in them. And so in battery, we have come up with a technology that we tap into the energy that is left in the battery, and we excrete all the juice out of the battery before you throw it away. Hence, we extend the life of the battery.
Oh, I have to tell you, Dan, I didn't believe this until I put it in there. We had just one example. We had a clock that stopped running. We put it in, and by golly, it's still running 3 weeks later. Same battery that was supposed to be dead. So we know it works. Now, Dan, I know you always come up with good questions to ask, so I'll turn it over to you.
No pressure there, huh? Thank you for joining us on the show today, Bob. I want to know is how – so if I understand your business model, you are supplying the wrapper to the consumer who has the battery in their house.
Yes.
Okay. And so when your wrapper can't produce any more juice in the battery – that's when the battery gets thrown out.
Absolutely.
And goes to the landfill. Okay,
yes.
So let's take Don's case. He took the battery, thought it was bad, out of his clock. He put your wrapper on it, put it back in the clock. It's now worked for 3 weeks. I understand you to say, I want to make sure I understood it. Did I understand you to say that there could be batteries that the consumer is throwing away could still have as much as 60% of their power?
Absolutely. There was a study done by Dr. Zinnecker, and he presented his paper in an international conference on battery recycling. And he calculated, and he went to a recycling center, and he grabbed tens of thousands of batteries out of the recycling bins, and he measured those batteries, and he found out that, as I said, there are 15 billion batteries consumed every year, alkaline batteries included. 20% of all batteries thrown away, 20% of all batteries thrown away still have 93% energy left in it. That means there are 20% of these batteries get thrown in the landfill with significant amount of energy, which is almost 93%, almost full. 30% of batteries that are thrown away still have 84% energy left in it. It is mind-boggling that that this significant amount of waste is being created by people buying these batteries, very expensive source of energy, and they get thrown in the garbage, and they're generating a hazardous environmental hazardous condition. Manufacturing these things, these batteries every year, it puts 1.2 million tons of CO2 in the air. So there was a study done. They said green gas emission are major environmental concern due to their potential effect on global climate changes. And there was a study done by California Department of Resources, it said that battery production and manufacturing was listed as a major source of greenhouse gas emission in the study that was done in 2010-2011 by California Department of Resources and Recycling. And by the way, if you imagine 15 billion batteries, they end up in a landfill each year, you put them on top of, if you could place these batteries on top of one another, you will go to the moon, you wrap around the moon 2 times, and you will come back to Earth. These are the number of batteries end up in the landfill every year. And a study has shown only 2% of these batteries get recycled. And the reason for that is, even though everybody would love to recycle and everybody's encouraged to recycle, it is very expensive to recycle. So it is more expensive to recycle the alkaline battery rather than manufacture. So people will always find an easier way to say, okay, I don't care about saving money, I'm saving the environment, I will go and I will not to increase my profit. So the battery company, they do not recycle the batteries. Only 2% gets recycled. And as I said, it is a very expensive source of energy. And the way that we do that, you know, that if you look at the 15 billion batteries that end up in the landfill every year, you know, in U.S., we got about 3.5 billion. The rest of the globe has about 12 billion units of alkaline battery. And the way that we came up with this idea is my brother, you know, he's also a co-founder and executive chairman in this company. He has over 500 patents under his belt. He got probably another 300 patents that in process of getting approved. So he has, you know, he has a major, major number of patents that he has under his belt. And, you know, he was on a vacation in Tahoe with his kid, and they were, you know, at midnight, the kids, they wanted to play some game, and they ran out of the battery. And, you know, he always carries this, you know, a whole bunch of batteries, a recycled battery, you know. And he started measuring the voltages with a voltmeter, and he saw that a lot of these batteries, they have 1.3, 1.35 volts. And a brand new battery has about 1.5 volts. And according to the battery company, you know, you can go all the way to 0.8 volts before they completely, you know, die. So he came to me and he says, you know, you have been doing 30 years of power management and, you know, with a PhD in electrical engineering and your expertise in power management. Is there any way that we can, you know, we can do something to extract the energy out of these batteries? And then we said, no problem. I sat down and we designed a circuit that basically boosts the voltage. And then we did some testing. As we tested, we found out that, yes, we could extract a lot of energy out of the battery. Again, depends on a different type of application. You know, the application that takes more energy out, you know, with a higher current, then it has a shorter lifespan. Therefore, you know, we can really extend the life of the battery significantly because, you know, maybe it has 80% energy left in it before they get thrown away versus some devices maybe has only 30% energy left before you throw away. So we can say that on average people will have the benefit of using the battery technology in order to extend the life of the battery. And that's how, you know, how we came up with the idea. And then, you know, we went and built the company and built the circuitry and the technology that, you know, as I said, most people do not realize that they throw batteries away with significant amount of energy left in them. And so we can squeeze all the juice out of the battery before they get thrown away. And then you can reuse the same, a sleeve over and over and over, our technology, you know, basically allows you to achieve this, improvement by miniaturizing mechanical design, miniaturizing industrial design, electronic and IT packaging design, which wouldn't have been possible, you know, maybe 10 years ago. So
let me ask you a question. Do regular batteries, alkaline batteries, lithium batteries, are they all the same in terms of their rechargeability or recovery, or are basic some batteries better at it than others?
So that's an excellent point. You know, we basically boost the voltage, and we don't care about the chemistry. So we are chemistry independent. However, your point that you brought up is extremely important. With regard to lithium battery, for example, if you look at the lithium battery, you know, the major brand advertised that this is going to last 9 times longer compared to alkaline battery in certain applications. And then, you say, okay, then if the alkaline battery capacity, let's say, is 3,000 milliamp hours, if the lithium battery is going to last 9 times, it should have 27,000 milliamp hour capacity. But in reality, alkaline battery has 2,000 milliamp hour capacity, and lithium battery happens to have 3,000 milliamp hour, capacity. So the capacity is exactly the same. However, the discharge, that you know, the discharge curve as we look at it is very flat, and that's why alkaline battery, lasts nine times longer in certain applications. We do exactly the same thing. They've done it, they've done it chemically. You're doing it electronically. However, the problem with the lithium battery is also that, they start about 1.5 volts nominal voltage, and they do drop to about 1.3 volts, and they stay at 1.3 for a long time. But, we basically not only extending the life of the battery, however, we also improve the performance of the battery because we boost the voltage to 1.5 volts, for example, and the device sees a brand new battery all the time. So imagine you put a flashlight, you put some alkaline battery in the flashlight. As you use it, as the battery gets older and older because due to the usage, you see that the light intensity gets smaller, gets degraded, gets smaller and smaller. And so what we do is basically maintain the voltage of 1.5 volt at a very high level, and by doing that, you see a brightness, full brightness all the way. For example, if you put it in a toy car that runs, a toy train, for example, that goes around the track, as you put a brand new battery in there, it slows down. The train will slow down and keep slowing down. It comes to a grinding halt. You put a battery sleeve on a brand new battery and you put it in there, it will maintain a performance, a peak performance, just like a brand new battery continuously, and it goes much, much, much faster than the one without the battery sleeve.
Dan, can I interrupt here and tell you that I also had an A battery like that, and did exactly what he said, and to one of those rundown battery flashlights. And you know what? He's right. We try to test every product, Dan.
Sure.
And I just have to tell you, the reason he's on this program on my part is the fact that everything they said is true. But the question is, how much does their product cost, and where is it available?
Right now, it's available on our website as a direct, people can get on batteroo.com. Batteroo is just like battery. Take the Y out and put two O's in there, so it becomes batteroo.com. They can go and order a sleeve for AA. A AAA is about $2.50. So we have a pack of four. Because every household has about at least 25 different battery-operated devices in the United States, and on the average, we go through 70 to 80 batteries a year. So we thought we should sell a four pack for about $9.99.
So it's four sleeves, four battery sleeves in
yes,
the
sir.
Package, and it's how much money?
It's about $10.
Four batteries for $10. And what does it cost to buy a new battery, four new batteries?
Well, okay, we don't sell the battery. We just sell the we sell the sleeve that wraps around the battery.
I understand, but I'm trying to help the consumer look at what they pay for a battery. If they spend $10 for your four sleeves, and if I heard you correctly, you can reuse them, so they can – is there a life expectancy on the sleeves? Or they'll just keep on going forever.
That's a very good point. I think we can, if you're careful using it, you can use it over and over and over. We've gone through, extensive testing. We use it over 150 times and still was perfect. So there's, it's a mechanical wear down. If people misuse it electronically, there's, you can use it forever. There's nothing wrong with it. So the cost of sleeve for a battery is about $2.50. A cost of AA battery, let's say, if you go on the average, let's say it's about $1. If you can extend the life of the battery by 6x, we put it in a GPS, for example, that Garmin has, and we had independent tests done by UL, which is one of the most prestigious lab in the world. And also we have done some other independent testing with another international prestigious lab, MedLab, that is called MedLab, that they verified that, for example, UL certified that, you know, if you use battery sleeve with a GPS device, it can extend the life of the battery by 600%. So imagine, you know, instead of using six batteries, $6, you spend about $2.50. Now it already paid for itself. Now you can reuse it hundreds of times. So there's tremendous amount of saving. It is not only saving money, it's also saving the environment. Of course, you know, battery company would not, battery industry wouldn't like us because it will significantly reduce the number of batteries that they sell. But it's really good for consumer and it's good for environment as well.
Can I ask,
how much time do we have?
We have 4 or 5 minutes, but can I interrupt here and point out to this audience, we have the traditional problem. Here's the inventor of the product that, as far as I can determine, has very little fallback or downsize, and who's explaining it, and then Dan comes in and really explains the value of it. And most small businesses do not have the ability often to explain the true value. And we hope in our program to do that for our audience. And that's all I want to say, Dan. Now you can ask a question, but I really think it's important because Batteroo, as far as we can determine, is one of the best products we've come across in a long time.
You're selling it only – since we have a little bit, not much time left, you can buy it online. Is it sold in any stores, or are you talking to anybody like Amazon or anybody else about the sale of the product?
Well, there's a tremendous amount of interest in different retailers that we have spoken with, but for right now, the easiest route for us is to handle all the orders directly through our own e-commerce website, and you know, we'll be happy to, because we would like to make that connection with the consumer and make sure that they get all the support that they needed directly from us and our engineering team and our customer service team. One of the things that I would like to also bring up is, you know, we were very fortunate that we found out that CNN Money, that they had 36 coolest gadgets of the year in 2015, and Batteroo was selected as number 9 most innovative coolest gadget of the year, and then you know, then they had some of the very, very major companies, Apples and Galaxies of the world, Samsungs of the world, they were you know, toward the end while we were number 9. So it was a great honor to have that. And then we were selected by Frost and Sullivan with regards to price performance value leadership award of the year for last year. So I mean, you know, it's been really nice to get recognition from folks like yourself, CNN Money, and others. You know, when we went on Indiegogo initially and promoted our product, as you know, Indiegogo is a crowdfunding source, and they basically promote a part, you know, to support the innovation. And we had almost $500,000 worth of product that we sold over a very short period of time. So we've been extremely fortunate to have, you know, people, folks like such as yourself, to support us. And get us, you know, get the word out with regards to the company.
Well, we're really glad, Bob, that you were with us today. Tell us again your website and spell it out for our audience.
It's Batteroo, B A T T E R O O .com. Batteroo.com.
Well, we have to have you back later on, early next year, to find out how you've been doing, because as far as I'm concerned, It's one of the most innovative products I've seen this year and in past years. Thank you so much. Dan, your thoughts?
Thank you. No, it was an interesting interview, and good luck with your sales. And I agree with Don. We should have you back in a year or next year to see how sales are progressing. Interesting idea. Thank you for being on the show with us
today.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's been my pleasure. Thank you very, very much. God bless you.